Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. World AIDS Day is December 1st. That's this coming Friday. In Tulsa, the day is honored by remembering those lost to the HIV epidemic. In 2016, it's estimated that 1.1 million Americans are infected with HIV, with almost 40,000 new cases each year. In Oklahoma, there are about 6,000 people living with HIV, with about 300 or so new cases annually. Fortunately, here in Tulsa, there are resources for getting tested, treated, and supported. In honor of World AIDS Day, we have two guests. Kate Neary, Chief Executive Officer of Tulsa Cares, a local nonprofit that provides support services including counseling, case management, and nutrition for those with HIV. We also have Dr. Madri Ladd, a Clinical Assistant Professor of Internal Medicine with OSU's Department of Internal Medicine. She works at OSU's Ryan White-funded Internal Medicine Clinic taking care of those with HIV. In my medical training, I remember caring for patients infected with HIV who developed full-blown AIDS, often with opportunistic and uncommon infections or unusual cancers because of the virus's damage to the immune system. Fortunately, there are an abundance of well-tolerated medications that suppress the virus and keep it in check, helping those with HIV live full lifespans without progressing to AIDS any longer. Kate Neary from Tulsa Cares and Dr. Madri Ladd of OSU Internal Medicine, who has a certificate in HIV care, are my guests today to help commemorate World AIDS Day on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Kate Neary, Dr. Madri Ladd, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start just by talking, what is World AIDS Day?
Well, World AIDS Day is a national remembrance of what's going on in the HIV world, remembering those that have passed, and just a reminder of all the work that needs to be done and a celebration of all of the advances we made and the fight to continue to take care of people living with HIV.
And Dr. Madri Ladd, how many people are living with HIV in either Oklahoma or Tulsa now? Are you aware of the numbers?
Yes, so in Oklahoma, we're over 5,000, almost up to 5,600 in the state of Oklahoma. In Tulsa, we're covering the eastern half of the state with the Oklahoma State University Ryan White Clinic, and that's 1,100 patients.
Wow. Okay. And so of those 1,100, I guess one question that always sticks out in my mind is I worry that I read about this, that there are people out there who aren't tested, who either, you know, don't want to get tested or are sort of in denial or think they might be at risk or just don't know to get tested or what have
Sure.
you. So do we have any estimate of that either, you know, in Oklahoma or in the United States, for example?
Sure. So they have nationally a continuum of care for HIV. And so when we look at the continuum nationwide, about 80% are diagnosed. So we're still missing 20% of those infections nationwide. Out of those 80%, then we drop to 60% with linkage to care. And then retention in care, staying on treatment, drops to about 40%. We place them on medications and try to get them virally suppressed or controlled on medications, and that drops to about 35%. Those statistics are from 2011. Those numbers are improving over the years, and we look at that same continuum of care of HIV nationally in 2014. We're up to 49% in suppressing the viral load for patients. At our clinic currently, we're at 85% of keeping patients virally suppressed. Out of the HIV drug assistance programs and Ryan White clinics in the nation, Oklahoma made the top 10 states for keeping patients virally suppressed.
So that's actually really outstanding to have such a high percent of patients, 85% that are virally suppressed, and to be in those top 10 states, because we often, I mean, on this program, and we know and we read it in the newspaper, hear it all the time, that we have we do very poorly as a state in terms of health indicators due to diabetes and obesity and tobacco use and abuse.
Yes.
So hearing that we do so well with HIV care. So what do you think is the secret sauce? I mean, why have you been so successful at OSU with the Ryan White Clinic in terms of getting people both into care and then getting them to stay on their medication?
Our presence in Tulsa has been there for a while. We do have some patients that have been in care for 20 years, and I think that probably helps our numbers. But there's struggles that all of us have, and there are still barriers to care, barriers to patients getting diagnosed, and we still have those barriers of keeping patients in care even when they are in care initially and get lost because of barriers, whether it's housing or IV drug use or other social issues, mental health, that come up where we lose them to care and try to get them back into care. Those are struggles that we're still dealing with each day.
And just for our listeners, remind us who Ryan White is or was.
Sure. Ryan White was diagnosed with AIDS, and it was due to a blood transfusion. He was actually a hemophiliac. This was in December of 1984, and he was only 13 years old. This was in Cremona, Indiana. Him, as well as his mother, they both fought and rallied for the discrimination that existed during that time. They fought for him to attend school. And he was given at that time only 6 months to live, but he actually lived for about 5 years. He died a month before his high school graduation, and that was a few months before they actually passed, Congress passed the Ryan White Comprehensive AIDS Resources Emergency Act, which is the CARE Act. That's August of 1990, which is what our funding is, our Ryan White funding. Is related to the CARE Act.
That yeah, thank you for that reminder, because obviously that was, I remember those days, it was a big issue. So a few things to comment on. Number one is that he was only expected to live a very short time, 6 months, which yes. often was the prognosis in the 1980s for someone with HIV, because we had really no tools with which to treat people.
Correct.
And that just shows the evolution. I mean, you say you now have people at the clinic who've lived 20 plus years.
Yes.
And that's amazing. I mean, we've seen this proliferation of different classes of medications now used to treat patients with HIV to the point where they just have chronic HIV. It's a chronic illness that
Correct.
They die with, not because of. And so Kate Neary of Tulsa Cares, Dr. Maddie Ladd told us about some of the social challenges. So tell us about Tulsa Cares and what your mission is.
Sure. So Tulsa Cares has been around 26 years now, and it was really a grassroots effort organized by family members and community members in Tulsa who were rallying around all of these people that were dying essentially of HIV and had no resources, particularly for the social issues surrounding access to care, transportation, social support, food pantry needs. And it was really an amazing effort with a lot of help from the Community Service Council of Tulsa. We were founded in 1991 and are very proud of the fact that we provide really comprehensive wraparound services specifically for people living with HIV and AIDS. And so our goal, along with the Ryan White Clinic, is to get all of our clients virally suppressed, so getting their viral load as low as possible so that they can go on and have the average lifespan that somebody without HIV is living with. Most all of our clients are very low income, and so a lot of the issues they're dealing with are around housing, access to care, transportation, assistance with prescription drugs. So our services are focused on getting them in care, keeping them in care, addressing any kind of family support needs they have. We offer mental health services, support groups, a very robust nutrition department that offers weekly meals, food pantry, a farmer's market, medical nutrition therapy through our registered dietitian. So really trying to address all of the social, medical, and psychosocial needs that our clients have so that they can focus on their HIV, but also many other things that people living in poverty deal with. Housing is a big issue, utility assistance, and then also just the social support. A lot of our clients deal with isolation. They've been alienated by a lot of family and friends. And so providing social activities and social support is a big part of their quality of life needs.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guests today are Dr. Maddie Ladd, who's a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Internal Medicine. She's also certified in HIV medicine at OSU College of Health Sciences. And Kate Neary, who's the CEO of Tulsa Cares. And we're talking about HIV in Oklahoma and the world. It's going to be World AIDS Day on Friday, December 1st. And Kate, what are some of the, you mentioned, I think, something with Oklahoma Equality holding a vigil that night?
There are several things going on that we're going to be doing, some client activities, some remembrance activities for some of our clients and family members who have passed. We'll also be collaborating with Oklahomans for Equality that holds an annual vigil that evening at their location at 4th and Kenosha. So just several things, small and large, just to remember what's still going on and helping remember those who've passed.
And Maddie Ladd, Dr. Maddie Ladd, you have reminded us about just how things have changed so much in the HIV era. It's a good example, is it not, of what you can do with comprehensive care for a population, and that is when you provide adequate insurance, so you get people covered, mm-hmm. which is really what the Ryan White Act did. You provide medication, which is another thing the Ryan White Act did and still does, and then you provide sort of that specialty level of care plus wraparound services, nutrition, we've made amazing progress. I mean, amazing progress.
Amazing. We also do primary care for a lot of our patients as well. So they may be seeing us. Well, most of us are internists. We have a residency program. They're training in the Department of Internal Medicine, and all of our attendings are attendings that are certified in the treatment of internal medicine. And so we're doing primary care for these patients too, because a lot of times they don't just have HIV, they also have hypertension or diabetes, and it's nice when they can go to one place and receive treatment for all their chronic illnesses.
And you told me a little bit about the statistics, but is it about two-thirds of the patients are men? Is that right?
That's correct. Our clinic is 18% female. And so we do have a large male population.
And you said it's the residents that are often getting that exposure and seeing patients in that clinic. So they spend a couple of years or more where they're getting to know these patients over time. I mean, a real longitudinal effort. So I got to imagine that's a very intense formative experience for these doctors in training.
Oh, definitely is. I trained through the program, and I felt very comfortable with the treatment of HIV when I was done with my training in internal medicine. I went and was a hospitalist for 7 years and then came back to the program to teach. But I found even then that HIV had changed so much in that period of time. And, you know, constantly having to update and look at guidelines because things are changing all the time with HIV. But it's a good thing because it keeps you on your toes. You want to be on top of those guidelines and making sure that we're providing standard of care. But that's what these residents are learning as they're going through their training. They will be very, very comfortable with treating HIV when they're done. The training program is 3 years, but 2.5 of those 3 years, they spend a half day a week in the HIV clinic taking care of patients.
So we've alluded to this term viral suppression, which I think, you know, if you're sort of in healthcare or you're in the HIV world, you know exactly what that is. But I think let's take a step back. So
Sure. People
who are infected, it could be with any viral disease, like hepatitis C is a good example. But let's just say, so if you have that virus, suppressing the virus means just lowering the count of virus in your bloodstream. And we do that with medication. And so in HIV care, what are you have, I think, four different classes, you told me, of drugs. Multiple medications?
Correct. This is how I describe it to patients. The virus is smart, and so we have to outsmart it. So we use most of the time three medications, and that may be at least two different classes of medications, but three different drugs to treat HIV. And what we're doing is we're not curing the virus because there's no cure, but we're controlling the virus. We're outsmarting it. So the importance of getting someone on treatment with those at least three medications and staying on treatment, complying with daily medications, because missed doses can lead to the virus mutating and getting resistant, and it sometimes doesn't take very much. The more they comply with medications, it takes that risk away.
Obviously, their quality of life is drastically improved if we can get that viral load down, but also the chances of passing on the virus to somebody else if you have a suppressed viral load is virtually impossible. So that's a huge benefit, not just to the patient's health, but to partners and future partners, that if we can get them down to an undetectable viral load, it's incredibly difficult to pass on to somebody else.
Do you find that when you get folks down to an undetectable viral load, that this majority of the time, I guess, for example, that they stay there? Or are these sort of social impediments or housing or drug abuse or other things? You know, I guess you have both. I mean, you have some that stay there and some that sort of relapse, as it were, with the viral load.
Yes, we do. And that's the importance of making sure we try our best to address all of the different social problems that a patient might be dealing with. But it's getting them in safe and stable housing, making sure they have the transportation to get to the pharmacy and to see their doctor, addressing any kind of mental health, the anxiety or depression or anything they might be dealing with around their disease or anything else that life may bring them. And also making sure they have healthy foods and taking care of other health conditions they might have, like diabetes or high blood pressure. So trying to address all those needs really helps that viral suppression.
That is so important, because these barriers come up all the time. So if we can address them on the initial visit, knowing what were the barriers in the past, if they'd been in care and got lost to care, if we can address those issues, and that's why the effort together to come up with what are the barriers in this situation, or are there barriers, or are they going to do fine when we place them on medications, is so important at that initial visit.
How good is the crosstalk between your two organizations? I mean, I know, Dr. Ladd, you serve on the board of Tulsa Cares and certainly are an expert in the field, but for example, like, do the internal medicine residents actually spend time at Tulsa Cares? That would be an amazing thing, I think, for them to see firsthand kind of what are some of the social challenges. Or do either of the organizations do house calls, or is that not? They're really center-based care. I mean, you're having the clients, patients come to you to receive care. And you mentioned transportation is a big issue.
We do some house calls, and we actually have one staff member that focuses on rural areas, people that are housebound for whatever reason or have transportation issues, or we deliver groceries a lot of times. But we have a really collaborative relationship with the Ryan White Clinic, obviously a lot of overlap in our patients and clients. We also provide some medical nutrition therapy through our dietitian on-site at the Ryan White Clinic for patients that already have an appointment at the clinic, and are exchanging lab work and all kinds of information that will help us take better care of our clients on the social end of things while they're getting good medical care at the clinic.
So, Maddie Ladd, over at OSU, there's Ryan White federal funding. There's also, of course, a lot of the patients will have a SoonerCare or Medicaid to pay for visits. But Kate Neary for Tulsa Cares, how are you guys all philanthropically supported, or are there government grants, or are you able to bill for services, or how does that work?
So, sure, it's a combination of all of those. We are a United Way agency and are very fortunate to get a grant from the United Way. We're also privately funded through some local foundations and individuals. We also receive several public contracts through federal dollars through HUD, which is HOPWA funds, Housing Opportunities for People Living with AIDS, through the city of Tulsa and the state, and then through private dollars. So
nice.
A combination of those things. And we are able to bill a little bit through Medicaid for some of our mental health services, but very little. It's all pretty much privately funded.
How has the organization grown over the decades?
We've grown quite a bit. We actively case manage about 650 clients, and those are all clients living with HIV and AIDS. We also serve an additional about 150 clients who may be partners or family members of clients that we serve through our congregate meals or mental health services support groups. So about 800 people a year that we serve, which is about the 650 actively case managed clients, or about 40% of the positive population in Tulsa. So it's a good chunk we're able to reach, but like Maddie said, there's still quite a few people that are out of care or undiagnosed.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guests today, in honor of World AIDS Day, are Kate Neary, she's the CEO of Tulsa Cares, and Dr. Maddie Ladd, who is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Internal Medicine, also certified in HIV medicine at the OSU College of Health Sciences, where she works in a Ryan White-funded clinic taking care of people in eastern Oklahoma with HIV. And Dr. Ladd, I was wondering, these classes of medications, I've been kind of pleasantly surprised that I think in the early days, like I was training back when these things were first coming out, and I remember sort of that many of them had sort of bad side effects.
Yes.
And we just don't seem to hear about that anymore. Is the newer medications don't seem to have the same level of side effects? And I mean, you mentioned people are living normal lifespans and dying from the things that people without HIV die from. So it's just kind of miraculous.
Definitely. I'm seeing a lot of the new patients that are coming through the clinic, trying to get them into care and place them on medications. And I don't know how many times I hear they come back for that second visit. They've started their medications, and many times they don't even know they're taking the medication because they didn't have any side effects, and they tolerate it well, and they're starting to feel better. And that's more the scenario that I hear now than even 5 or 10 years ago, or even when I was in training, where we would place patients on medications, and they would come back, we had side effects, etc. I think research is being done and new drugs are coming out all the time, and that's addressing some of the side effects that were present with the older regimens. A lot of safer drugs in terms of kidney dysfunction, bone dysfunction. There's new drugs, even the drug that came out a little bit over a year ago, the old tenofovir, always known for kidney problems and bone problems. Now we have a safer tenofovir. So I can actually tell my patients that, you know, this is a safe drug and we need to get on medications and stay on medications, but don't have to worry about as many of the side effects nowadays because of the newer regimens.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly going to ease adherence, being able to stay on the medication.
Yes.
If you're not
and
having
the
side effects.
Other adherence thing that is nice is before, even 10, 20 years ago, you may have been taking multiple pills multiple times a day. So pill burden was a big barrier to adherence. But there are a lot of regimens now, one or two pills a day, once a day, don't have to worry about a twice a day regimen. So when I see, you know, and we didn't talk about the most common age group that I'm seeing, but when I'm seeing new patients, a lot of them are between the ages of 20 or 29. And you got to give them an easy regimen because 20-year-olds are busy, and there's a lot of things going on, and it's easier to take a one pill a day and not have to take a twice-a-day regimen for them to be able to adhere to therapy, and the compliance is important there.
So I'm curious, at either your internal medicine clinic at OSU or at Tulsa Cares, in terms of prevention and advocacy, do either of you do testing or anonymous testing? If someone wants to come in off the street and say, hey, I want to get an HIV test, or do you recommend they go to the health department for that or their primary care doctor?
We do offer testing when it's requested. We're able to do that for a client or their partner or friend that may come with them. There's also a very large testing site in town called Hope Testing, and they do a big bulk of the HIV testing in town, free and low cost. The health department does too. But I know that if clients request it, both of us can certainly accommodate that for free.
And what's the status now with, there's something called PrEP, I think, or pre-exposure prophylaxis?
It's exciting.
Yeah, so can one of you tell us about that?
I will let the doctor talk about the medical side of things, but I would say as far as prevention, if you may feel that you're at risk or your partner's positive, it's a really exciting science for our patients that not just getting them virally suppressed, which makes it very difficult to pass on to partners, but along with PrEP and PEP, it's making huge strides.
Yes. Yeah, tell us, clarify what's PrEP and what's PEP.
Sure. So PrEP being pre-exposure prophylaxis, and what we're trying to do in patients who are high risk, they may have a partner who's HIV positive or high risky behaviors that may put them at risk for getting HIV. It's one medication, it's tenofovir, that we use not as part of a treatment regimen. This would be for someone who doesn't have HIV to try to prevent them getting HIV. And we do have a protocol in place. We actually do write for PrEP through our OSU internal medicine clinic. And so we can see patients, talk to them about PrEP, and we have a protocol in place and making sure that we do that safely and appropriately. There are protocols that are in place, but what we found is there weren't many providers who were writing for PrEP in the state of Oklahoma, and we were having trouble finding someone to write for PrEP for a lot of our partners, because we may have partners of our patients that are HIV negative. And this is where we started doing some investigation and ultimately decided to write for PrEP through our OSU internal medicine clinic. We don't through the Ryan White, because all of our patients are positive.
Gotcha. That makes sense. So what about PEP? Post-exposure?
Post-exposure prophylaxis. And we don't currently have a protocol in place for that.
But that's something, I mean, even sort of a good old internist or family physician could read up on.
And their guidelines.
And that's where someone just says, hey, I've had an exposure, either with a known infected partner or someone I don't know the status of, or you've been using drugs or something, and then they can just actually get a prescription for essentially what amounts to triple therapy, right, to knock down any potential transmission is really the idea with that. Mm-hmm. So, Kate, I was wondering, what are some of the barriers you face with Tulsa Cares? I mean, it seems like you mentioned the tapestry of support throughout the community. The United Way obviously does a lot of homework in terms of which agencies that they support. And, of course, you have to have additional funding in order to be supported by United Way. So you have a beautiful center, right? The Charles Fodry Center.
We have a beautiful new center about a year and a half, and it has really elevated the level of service we're able to provide, not just for our core services, but to be able to offer a really safe, comfortable place for people to come and for social time too.
Yeah. I mean, I had a tour, and so I felt very comfortable.
We're very fortunate.
Lovely place. Mm-hmm. So going forward, what are some of your strategic visions, or what would you like to see for Tulsa Cares as you move along in the, rest of the decade or beyond?
Sure. So I'm coming up on a year at Tulsa Cares, and I've always been incredibly proud of the work Tulsa Cares does. Their programs really are amazing and very unique in the fact that there are so many different wraparound services offered for a very special population. But I think some of the things we're looking at and needs that we're seeing, we've got a great model of care for people living with HIV. We're looking at people living with Hep C. There's a huge gap in social support, education, and services for people. And we're looking at maybe ways that we can tailor our HIV program to serve Hep C. So we're looking at some funding ideas and working with some partners to see what we can do there. That would be something really exciting and to meet a huge need we have in Oklahoma for Hep C, further diagnostic testing, and then again, just the social support and access to other services that they need. We're also looking at, it's wonderful that people with HIV are living a lot longer now, but it's bringing along some issues around aging for our patients that maybe we didn't have before or need to address. And so we're looking at different things that seniors living with HIV are dealing with, LGBT seniors specifically, around mental health and nutrition and general health. So things around sexual health, communicable disease, things that we've had a focus on looking at where we can expand.
Well, I mean, in many ways, for the elderly, if you want to call it that, elderly folks with HIV, I mean, it's in some ways uncharted territory, right? Mm-hmm. Because people who had HIV often progressed and died and didn't live into. So do elderly folks who are HIV positive face unusual discrimination, or just, I mean, I hate to call it usual, but the usual stigmatization that somebody with HIV might face? Or is there something sort of different about it for someone who's elderly?
I think a lot of it is the same. I think some of the, there's more complicated health issues when you're looking at heart disease, diabetes, issues around that. But also isolation is a big issue too. We have a lot of people either a little bit transient or living alone. And so making sure that we have people that get to them or better ways that they can get to us. It seems to be a little more pronounced in the elderly.
And isolated population. Maybe mm-hmm. as well from their families due to HIV status or
yes,
sexuality.
Yes, and while we've made so many strides in the stigma around HIV, most all of our clients have experienced some level of discrimination, whether it's from their family, from their employer, from their housing situation. It's very, very common and still a very frustrating piece that we try to address in lots of different ways. But for our older clients that maybe their health is not so good and they don't have as much social support as some of our younger clients, that makes things more complicated.
So I just want to ask both of you, we're almost out of time, just your predictions. I mean, are we anywhere closer to, say, an HIV vaccine, something to prevent the transmission of HIV at all or you know, eradicate it as a disease? I mean, we're still talking about over 30 million people worldwide. Still, as I just heard at a meeting this weekend, still called an HIV pandemic across the world and still often difficult to treat in resource-constrained places, although I will say that PEPFAR, which was started under the administration of George W. Bush, has been an amazing diplomatic and medical tool to go abroad and really try to help with HIV treatment and advocacy. And do you know anything from your reading or your experience about a vaccine getting any closer?
So I think some things that are coming up soon, one is an injectable. And maybe where they wouldn't, you know, if we have patients that aren't able to comply with taking a medication every day, an injectable that can be done monthly every 2 months.
Oh, wow. That would really change things too.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's somewhere in the future. And there's always studies being done on cure.
So. Right. And we have, as Kate, as you mentioned, with hepatitis C, I mean, we now have, we literally can cure that virus.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is the first time in my lifetime that I think of using drug treatment to cure a viral illness. I mean, usually we're lucky and they recede except for some of these chronic infections. But yeah, it's curable.
And it really
happens
so fast. Yeah. And it's so if we can get to these people that are newly diagnosed, but they can't afford the further testing that's needed to get them into a treatment program. Yeah, huge advances in that area and a lot of potential to intervene and treat a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And fairly tolerable treatment plans as well. We're treating hepatitis C as well as co-infected HIV and hepatitis C and have had good success rates with it because particularly in those situations, HIV patients are at greater risk for cirrhosis of the liver, liver cancer, et cetera, when hepatitis C is uncontrolled along with their HIV. So, yes, many advances.
Well, World AIDS Day is on December 1st every year. And I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Maddie Ladd, who is a clinical assistant professor at the Department of Internal Medicine, and she's certified in HIV medicine at OSU College of Health Sciences, and Kate Neary, who is the chief executive officer of Tulsa Cares. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.